wafting across the pastoral vistas of the new basement studios by the lake, this is the Atlantic Voice Podcast, 3,000 miles of opinion.
This is Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric.
Down in the new basement studios by the lake. We are fortunate to have a show this week because we have been without power.
It was close. Yeah, the studio was powered down. We had a storm through the mid-Atlantic and up the East Coast area.
I guess it was a nor'easter.
It was a nor'easter. It was a little weird around here in the sense that usually you think of these storms as being rain or snow events.
A precipitous event.
Yeah. Instead, it was dry. Like, there's a little bit of drizzling at the beginning of it. It started on Thursday in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And so very high winds, like I think they hit 70 miles an hour, essentially near hurricane winds in some parts of Northern Virginia. Ultimately ended up with, I forget the numbers. It was
nearly 600, 700
that, in the D.C. area without power.
And I don't know how many people are studio. In this metro area. I think about 5 million, 6 million. I don't think we're as big as a big metropolitan.
It's a million in Fairfax or 1.3 million in Fairfax or something like 800,000 in D.C. Yeah, so that's probably 3 or 4 million.
Yeah, so a good bulk of the region was without power.
Yeah, and including the basement studios by the lake.
Yes.
As of Friday morning, and the power just came on. We're now Sunday, came on this morning. And
So you were without power for 48 hours?
A little more, yeah, 48 hours plus a few. So, power outage is always sometimes entertaining, sometimes annoying. This one was mostly annoying. It was a lot more fun when you were young and you'd be like, oh, look, the power's out. We're going to sit around with a candle and have beer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're not that young. It's funny. The last time I lived in a house that lost power for, more than a couple of hours, because that happens in the summer during storms and what have you, was during the derecho, which was a name given to derecho.
I think just derecho.
Derecho.
I don't think there's an EO or anything. D-E-R-E-C-H-O. Derecho.
Okay, derecho.
Which I just think means to the right.
Oh, really?
I mean, izquierda's left and derecho. Well, derecha is right in Spanish, I think.
So
it has something to do with that because
storms move.
Derecho is like this weird. Like, it's like a wall of wind that passes across very quickly towards the east. And I assume that's where the name comes from.
So I remember the derecho
came. Completely wrong. But
the derecho came through my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it was during, I think, July. We lost power for like 4 days. And so I wanted to ask you a sort of poll question. Is it better to lose power? We're in March, so this is not technically, this is the end of winter, this is the beginning of spring, but it is still cold.
Yeah, it was down in the 30s.
Is it better to lose power in the winter or lose power in the summer a 24-hour period? That is the question.
Yeah, well, 48-hour?
Now, my honest reaction is always, well, you're better off losing it in the summer. But if you live in this area, which is not, in the summertime, it gets extremely humid here. So it's not tropical.
Right.
But it is very oppressive. I guess subtropical, is that what we would call our summer climate here, where it's 95 degree days with X percent humidity?
Yeah.
Losing power in the summer was extremely unpleasant in that you couldn't sleep at night. It was the air wasn't moving. Whereas I do feel in the winter, yes, you're going to be cold, but you can, with the accoutrements of domestic life, blankets and what have you, you can get warm. In the summer, you can't get cool.
Yeah, well, but still, I was thinking that.
I mean, I don't know how I'm voting on this yet, but I'm just saying.
No. Yeah, so let's talk about personal comfort, and then we'll talk about some other factors. I hear that, right? And it's definitely annoying, and you can, to a certain extent, deal with the blankets. But the heat, even when it's hot, it's very hot, it won't kill you, right? Like, you can't be too hot to death.
Yeah,
okay. Whereas you can freeze to death, right? Like,
Okay.
And I think heat, like, what do you do? It's hot, you shower, you find some place to swim, or you just, if you were stuck for a week in the summertime, you can find ways to cool off. You just wander around your house in your underwear or something like that.
Ooh,
you just run a sink over your head or something, like very quick fixes.
Okay.
Whereas in the wintertime, when it's cold, your coal. Like, you know, that I'll mention some accommodations we can come up with there, but generally speaking, you're cold. We have fireplace. We actually have two gas fireplaces in the house. So I ran those almost continuously just to stave it off getting too cold.
Yeah. And you could have made toast and stuff with those.
Well, gas fireplace.
Oh, we used to.
One is a sealed box.
We've never done that.
So you can't put the toast into that.
No. When I was a kid, we had a gas fireplace.
Well, we have
and you could put it on a fork and you could toast your bread.
Over your gas fireplace?
Yeah, it wasn't like the modern gas fireplaces all have glass fronts.
Yeah, well, one of the ones event, doesn't but one, here. So
talking one of those
that.
Open ones, yeah, you get one of those long toasting
forks. We also have gas.
I mean, I wouldn't do s'mores; it messes everywhere.
Right, we have gas supplies. So there's the stove. The stove top is gas.
Okay.
So I actually tried to.
Right, so you wouldn't need to make toast because you could make toast for real. Yeah. Okay.
I warmed up. I tried warming up pizza in a pan. And it didn't really work that well.
Oh, didn't?
Yeah.
You weren't doing it right.
The heat was too much on the bottom, and it was really going to take a long time to get through without burning the bottom of the pizza.
You know the secret to that?
What's the secret?
Use cooking spray, or if not, like a little bit of butter, like a conductor.
Yeah, but that doesn't help you, like, melt the cheese on top again.
Well, no, but it warms up your pizza.
Yeah, if you want to melt the cheese,
you've got to flip it.
Well, you can't put pizza upside down in a pan.
But that's my point. I mean, but you can still
I tried putting a pan on top so it would catch a certain amount of heat, like a little mini oven. Okay. The oven is electric. We have this weird setup where the oven's electric and the stove top is gas.
How did your homemade attempt at a double pan oven work? Did it work?
It was better than cold pizza, but it was not like a fully warm pizza. And I was too impatient to like sit around and like have it warm on there for 20 minutes.
All right, so I'm now going to make a case.
So anyway, so that personal comfort wise, I like this morning, the house got down with the fireplaces going, the house got down to 55 degrees, I think.
Yeah, but, and again, I'm going to make the case that somehow power in the summer is worse than winter. Even though you were without power, look how much fun you were having trying to cook pizza and getting two, so something, it's an activity.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. 40 minutes are done, and you're like, oh, wow, another 40 minutes passed. It was in the summertime,
but when I got
just
up,
sweating.
When I got up in the 55 degree weather, I awoke. I shouldn't say I got up, because now you get all these blankets. I'm not excited about getting up. There's no power. Can't watch anything on TV. You know, I can get in the newspaper, and I codged the other way to make coffee because I just did a pour over coffee.
Were you able to charge your devices in your car or anything like that?
We went to a restaurant. Oddly, it was a very small pocket here that's out of power. So literally two blocks away from here has power. So I went and visited a neighbor and got the power. So that on the personal comfort side, I'm going to say summer is better to lose power. Like, it's annoying, but, you know, you're not going to, like, you don't have to hide away under blankets. I did a lot of sitting in front of these fireplaces with, like, multiple layers of sweaters because that was the only way to be warm in the house. The other thing is, keep in mind, the summertime, it's not the heat, but it's got longer days. So you don't run out of light till, like, 8 o'clock, whereas here the light was gone by 6, and you're like, I got X out, you know, 5 hours to burn before I'm going to go to bed.
Yeah.
Like, I don't figure what to do with those things.
Yeah.
Whereas if the light was out till 8 o'clock, it would be less problematic that way.
I don't know. See, I'm the other way around. And while I don't want to shortchange it, obviously the lack of heat, you know, it could kill you. But I just feel in the summertime, when you're in your house and the air's not moving, and you can't sleep at night, and you just, there's no relief. I feel that somehow the summer is worse. It feels worse. Whereas in the winter, you can do things. Again, if you're cold, you can break the cold for a short amount of time by getting under a whole load of blankets. And do you know what I mean? Whereas in the summertime, oppressive heat, there's no defense to that. You can't.
Well, like I said, there's the water and things.
I don't want to be ducking my head.
You know,
people
have always needed heat, but they haven't always needed air conditioning. You know, people have managed to get by in history without air conditioning. But here's the other part that we haven't talked about is stuff in the refrigerator, right? Like refrigerator and freezer. Like once you get to 48 hours, now things are starting to, like, you leave your fridge closed, and if you have power outage for 4 hours, it's not going to make any difference. Everything's going to basically stay the same temperature. But now at 48 hours, the stuff in the fridge is now approaching room temperature. And the stuff in the freezer is starting to defrost. Obviously a bigger problem in the summer than the winter.
Yes.
Now, it wasn't quite cold enough here for this because it was 30s to 50s each day. But like in the real winter ones, you just take everything out of the freezer and put it outside.
Yeah,
you know, when you have a snowstorm, you
can do that one time.
Whereas in the summertime, you're losing stuff. You know, like
I had one time where my fridge went on the blink in the winter. So I had no option but to put food outside. And I still had power because I just lost the use of the fridge. And at the time, I must have had about 4 pounds of cheese in the freezer. So I immediately went into this thing where I just made a massive macaroni and cheese and stuff like that. But because it's winter, you did feel less stressed. You know, you could buy some ice from the convenience store and dump food in a cooler. And I just felt like, okay, this wasn't too bad. It was in the summertime. You know, once you lose power for a 24-hour amount of time, you're suddenly in this sort of like, and again, because I'm a minge bag, the notion of wasting any of this stuff, it's just a complete anathema to me. So I'm like, you're just constantly eating and doing whatever, because the thought of, I'm looking at all this food in the fridge going, yep, that's $40 I'm just throwing down the drain. So
I'll add another piece that doesn't present itself here, but it has presented it for myself in the past, is where I grew up, we had well water. So the water was actually drawn out of an aquifer in a well.
Okay.
It's not like there was a big bucket in the backyard that you
had one of those things that you twist.
But the well runs on electricity.
But it still comes out of your tap.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Sorry. Until you know, like there, when the power would go out, whenever we knew the power might go out, we'd fill a bunch of tubs with water.
Okay.
Because like the well brings water up to a tank, the tank's under pressure, you've got a certain amount of water, but you'll run out. Like if you're going to have power out for a week, you're not going to have water.
Yeah.
So that becomes a greater complication, although I'm not sure if summer or winter is worse in that regard. You basically fill the tubs up so you can flush the toilet, because then you can just dump the water into the toilet and it flushes itself.
Yeah, but you can flush you don't need power to flush the toilet.
You do to get the water. If I have a well water, I'm not going to have enough water.
Oh, if you have well water, I'm sorry.
I can flush the toilet once.
Yeah, you're right.
But I can't. I don't have any replacement water to run. That's why I said, like, basically you'd have a water tank full of water. So you weren't like, oh, we're going to like dehydrate and die. But you can't use water the way you normally can.
Right. So you were without power for basically 2 days. Mm-hmm. How long did it take when power returned, which is not long ago as we speak? Yeah, I mean, because I'm here in a new basement studio right now, and I feel like this
we're back up to normal temperature. It was 2 hours or something like that.
Oh, okay.
Up from 55 to 68 or whatever we've got it in here. I was still running the fireplaces. I just turned off the one outside because I was afraid it was going to make noise in our podcast here. But
I do feel, if anything, the loss of power with who we are now as a society, and that's why I asked the question a couple of minutes ago, were you able to charge your devices? For me, when the power goes out, I can stumble around in the dark.
Yeah.
I can fumble around for food, but the inability to watch TV or get Wi-Fi, that's a killer for me.
And the phone, you know, because cell phone wise, once upon a time, you know, your cell phone would last for days, and now you're only going to get 24 hours and you want to look at it, and that's a good way to occupy your time. But suddenly I'm having last night I turned it on to like the super low energy thing so that it wouldn't really use a lot of energy overnight. And you know, we were at a restaurant last night because I was looking for something to do, and I was looking around for an outlet to plug the thing in while I'm there at the restaurant so I can go home with a full charge. You know, but and all the devices, like, hey Google, how's the power outage?
According to Wikipedia, a power outage is a short-term or a long-term loss of the electric power.
So we brought a guest to this one here.
Because we're going to use that. Yeah. Not a guest. There's actually going to be a working
intern. And we brought our Google Home here so that we can flaunt our use of electricity, I guess, is basically the deal. But we're not doing the high-tech version where it's plugged into the soundboard, so we're probably just going to sound horrible.
Talking of flaunting, because I knew you had no power and was like, why don't you join the group, a few of us, for dinner last night? We went to an Indian restaurant where there was a live belly
London
dancer. London Curry Company. Will probably they're in not far from Landmark in the
Alexandria
area of Virginia. Classic Indian food, chicken tikka masala, biryanis, your breads.
There's a bunch of them. They had renamed them for British thing. Like the one I had was chicken tikka masala, whatever.
It was like Windsor Castle.
It was called Windsor Castle, you know, so that the London element was in there.
And they were also very big in terms of their menu, I noticed, where they would highlight certain things that say must try. Yeah. Did you notice that?
It's like, I can't must try everything.
And, well, and that's the thing. If you say, and you know, the food was very good, so I'm not having a pop at the London Curry Company. If you have a menu with about, I don't know, 24 choices, and you highlight 9 of them with must try,
right.
At a certain level, what's my incentive to try any of the others?
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, I was a bit,
yeah. I must try these 9, then I'm never going to get around to anything else. So,
but anyway, we went and they had a live belly dancer.
Live belly dancer, loud music to start. It's a very interesting meal because, like, it was very loud when we first got there and then the belly dancing
and they warn
phase
you,
stopped.
Yeah, if you come in, I've been there a couple of times during the belly dancer part of the evening.
Yeah.
And she's just roaming around the restaurant dancing.
There's more than one, or is there one? I had my back to most of it.
No, there was one, but she sort of did a couple of goes.
Go outfits.
When you enter the restaurant and the belly dancer's going, the maitre d' always explains that, yes, we have a belly dancer for a short amount of time, but then you'll be able to sit and sort of converse and stuff. I do feel that maybe they're worried that they're going to lose customers who are going to be like, oh, I'm not eating my curry with all this noise going on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she I was going to say she played, but she, you know, she wobbled her way, I guess, jiggled her way around about 20-minute segment and then took some time off and worked the tables chatting away, and then she danced again.
Right. I think she had a little finger symbols for some of it, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, the little finger symbols. Yeah. And then...
So somebody at this table, not me, got up and danced with the belly dancer for brief moments. We're talking about like 60 to 120 seconds or something like that.
That would be me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Someone thrust a dollar bill into my hand, which apparently seemed to be the sign. And then when she came on, like, she saw and she came over. And obviously, if I was a belly dancer professionally, I'd just take your money. But right. She seemed to feel that she couldn't just take my money.
And it was the first wave is she had to get up the other person with us, a woman at the table. So it seemed like what was going on is really the women were being invited up and the one time up deferred and we threw it over to you and you got the
And I got up because I felt like I couldn't just give her the money. Somehow I had to interact with her. Right. Maybe that's what makes it different from a strip club. You have to get up and dance and then mm-hmm. we're not in some situation where you're given dollar bills. I don't know what the legality of all of that is.
Yeah.
And I got up and I gave it, you know, I gave it to business for about 60 seconds. I thought it was very impressive. I don't know how the other customers felt watching I'm watching a man of indeterminate middle age in a t-shirt.
Too bad you weren't wearing some Atlantic Boys gear at the time.
That's true, actually.
We don't have any shirts.
We need to make some.
Make a polo shirt with a little logo on the chest or something.
No, a t-shirt with a big one on the front.
We can do both. For classy and for less classy endeavors.
So anyway... After she came around and she was dancing for each table and I, you know, like I said, I got up and I danced away and gave her a dollar bill and she moved on to the next table. When her set was finished, she did mm-hmm. sort of go back around and chat with all the customers right. who had supported her. And she came back and had
yeah, I mean, what I thought was notable was, I mean, the proprietors, or at least the management, I don't know who owns the restaurant, were clearly of Indian descent.
Okay.
And so I just kind of assumed that she would be of Indian descent. And maybe she is of Indian descent, but like they had accents, like they were at least recent enough that they had been born in India. She came over, there's no accent.
Yeah, she was
at all.
From around here, yeah.
She mentions that she's got a Sicilian grandmother.
That's right. Yeah.
And then she talks about how she's got a cover on, like a blue velour thing, and I forget who at the table, wasn't me again, said something
probably
nice
me.
About it, liked it, you know, like but she starts to describe it as Middle Eastern.
Yes.
And I don't know if there was just a lack of communication or something, but, you know, a Middle Eastern cover-up isn't really the same as an Indian cover-up, I don't think.
Yeah.
Although Justin Trudeau, did you see the stuff about him being in Canada, and, you know, the Canadian Prime Minister was in India?
No, I didn't see this.
Oh, he was in India, and everybody in India was giving him a hard time because, like, everything he did as appearance there, he was dressed.
Hey, Google, play some belly dancing music while we It's great. It's like having a little...
You know, that's a very confusing sentence you just threw out there. Let's see what happens.
I looked for belly dancing music while we chill out his grace, but it either isn't available or can't be played right now.
It's all those extra words you've got.
Okay.
Hey, Google, play belly dancing music.
All right. Yearning by Raul Ferrando.
There you go.
Playing on Spotify.
Anyway, so the... And Justin Trudeau was there, and he's like all these appearances, and he had a different outfit. His whole family had different outfits every day for all this stuff. And everybody started giving him a hard time because it appeared that he got these outfits in Canada made for him brought them over, and a bunch of people were like, those are like cartoon versions.
They're not the real thing.
Like,
yeah. You know,
they were like overly, they were like, somebody said it would be like what you see in a bad Hollywood or Bollywood movie.
They were not indigenous
costumes.
Versus
what people would actually show up. Yeah. And there's even like some, I saw some interview with the designer anyway, et cetera, et cetera. So this kind of fits into the whole thing of like what she was wearing. I don't know if it was real or not.
No, but she said it was of Middle Eastern origin. It was very nice, sort of, you know, embroidered and weaved and what have you. And like I say, when she comes back around, she's covered herself up. And
right.
I don't know how
it wasn't like it wasn't, you know, like, so to be clear, it wasn't like she was really super naked or something like that. It was, you know, like a respectable looking belly dancing outfit. I mean, there was a belly, but there, you know, like there was a midriff, but it wasn't like somebody in a bikini top. It was like full.
I mean, stuff.
At one point, she had like lights in her like wings. She had these things on it, like on her arms, and they had Christmas lights on. They're like white lights.
I don't remember that.
Oh.
I mean, remember, I'd already had one big beer, which was why I'd stood up and started belly dancing with her. I mean, I think if I just had a cup of tea, I might have been a bit more reticent to get involved with the belly dance.
Okay, Google, stop.
Yeah. I mean, she had naked stomach and naked shoulders.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Well, so that's relatively naked. I mean,
it's more naked than not.
Yeah, you know. I mean, you said it. She wasn't like wearing a bikini. I don't know about that.
Didn't you have some problem with the nudity and food or something?
Yeah, I do have an issue with that a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't like to mix the two things. I'm one of those.
And there
people.
You were encouraging the situation with the dancing.
Well, to be fair, though, our food hadn't come out, so.
I can't remember. Was
no,
it?
No, because really,
food had been out because, in fact, there was a big piece of food on the end of the table that I was trying to, because as you made your way around the end of the table, I couldn't figure out, like, how did you not end up with it on you? Did it come from you? I couldn't.
No, I dropped it on the floor, and then I was sort of, So anyway, London Curry Company, very entertaining, good curry, and I would say, I've forgotten the young lady's name, very, very entertaining belly dancer. Not that I've had a lot of experience with belly dancers.
She did introduce herself, but I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember. So anyway, that was an activity in terms of getting you out of the house while the power was off.
That's right.
Yes.
So we are recording, as I mentioned, on a Sunday. It's the Sunday of the Oscars. So by the time we actually put this on the websites and
you'll know the winners.
The winners, the Oscars will be done. Yeah. Well, despite our active interest in the movie business, I would say. I have followed, you know, the award winners less than any year in the past.
I think in general, I've sort of gone off as I've got older. And I used to, you know, and I know we've had this conversation before. I used to love the Oscars. And again, you know.
I'll probably still watch them. It's fun to watch.
But. I mean, you have it on and you sort of interact with it as a TV show. But I used to love the Oscars in this whole notion of they're picking winners. And does it jibe with what I think in terms of what films I've seen? I do feel over the last couple of years, more so. I mean, there are always years when a film wins Best Picture and you have an opinion about whether it should have been Best Picture or not. I know when we had our discussion about Titanic, the movie, a couple of shows ago, I'd made the point that I felt that L.A. Confidential was a better movie that year. But I think that is part of sort of this effect that the Oscars have, is it forces you to have. You know, like I said, it's kind of like this sort of under-the-radar sales pitch where ultimately it is. It's an advert for the film industry, and it forces you all to sit around and talk and make comparisons. And it doesn't matter if you and I debate this year's best movies and we both agree that that one sucks and that shouldn't be there. The bottom line is that the Oscars as an event have forced us to have a conversation about movies.
Yeah, I mean, they don't advertise it in the sense of, like, going forward, they're an advertising for a thing, but I think by creating a award system, it drives people to get awards and talk about the awards, and, you know, because if you didn't have that, maybe everything would just be blockbuster, you know, sell like it's.
Well, and
but by the same token, you know, listen, they have award shows for advertisements, and, you know, people.
Well, and I will say this though, only for myself, as I've got older, I don't probably watch as many films as I used to. I definitely don't go to the cinema as much as I used to, but I still have an enjoyment, an appreciation, and an opinion on what's on in the cinema and what I do see. I found myself over the last couple of years in this sort of like weird disconnect place from the Oscars, that it represents an industry in a way that, you know, that is completely 180 degrees from my entryway into the industry. What I mean by that is I feel like less and less sort of I think last year, for example, I hadn't seen any of the best movies. And this year, I think I've only seen like two of them or something. Yeah. And so I think my general point is, I probably didn't say it properly right there. My general point is, I feel like it's discussing an industry of which I'm not familiar with.
Well, let's see. So award nominees for Best Picture. And by the way, remember, they expanded a bunch of years. So it used to be when they had four, you could like count on going to see them. But now they're up to like nine or whatever. Yeah. Call Me By Your Name.
I haven't seen it.
Get Out.
I didn't see it, but I knew all about it. And that. So that's me not that. Seeing it. So I'm going to...
Lady Bird.
Didn't see it.
The Post.
Didn't see it.
Phantom Thread.
Didn't see it.
Dunkirk.
Saw that.
Yeah. You saw it and own it. Yeah. Shape of Water.
Didn't see it.
Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
I did see that.
All right. Darkest Hour.
Didn't see that. So I'm running at two out of nine. How many?
Two out of nine, just different two.
Yeah.
Although Dunkirk we have in common.
And like I say, I felt myself 15, 20 years ago, there's no way now. Sure, it was only, as you said, it was only four or five movies, but I would have been two of five or three of five.
Right.
Whereas I feel consistently now, yeah, I'm just not seeing these things.
I'd like to get to the point where they just showed all these things on demand leading up. Because I think if they showed these things on TV, like The Exorcist, like this many movies... It used to be as the Oscars would approach, I'd actually try to go and see those movies out there when it was like four or five. Sure, that wouldn't necessarily hit them all, but like nine, I'm not going to see all these movies in a month or something that the nominations are out. But if you threw them all on demand, I might sit down and watch them all over the course of a couple of weeks, you know, just to know what's going on.
Yeah, so it is interesting that, you know, I feel that the Oscars is less relevant to me as an audience member, but... To be fair, I think it continues to be highly relevant to the industry itself because, to your point, they are hoping that some people are going out there in the 6 weeks between releasing these nominations.
Well, that's why I think the awards theaters and they don't roll them over to on demand as quickly. But
so, you know, I think we've both agreed we're going to have them on and we're going to sort of. But again, I don't feel it. There's no sense of drama to me, and I'm much more willing to.
The last year, very exciting. You know, they got them wrong. You could just tune in just for that kind of thing.
You can, but once you've done that, you really can't do it again, can you? Do you know what I mean? Well, it's like a one trick.
I read something talking about like how what's going to be going on in terms of.
If they start getting one wrong every Oscars, we're all going to sit here and go, this is a fix. You know?
Well, the security element here, because I mean, that was bad. They, despite it being sort of an interesting viral moment, I don't think anybody wants that to happen. The academies don't want that to happen. It's not nearly as serious as though. So my guess is that process of like announcing winners is going to be, there's like another safety valve this stuff, you know, fail safe, I guess would be the right term. So, well, is that there was an article in the Post recently talking about one particular category, Best Original Song.
And it's interesting, until you'd sent me the article, I'd never really thought about Best Original Song in the fact that the article wants... I think the gist of the article is, you know, when the Oscars pick Best Original Song, and they, I think that's still a category with, like, just five or six songs.
And
traditionally, if you watch the Oscars on TV, they will have a performance of the song, you know, throughout the show. It's a nice way to sort of bridge the...
Well, and they usually, for whatever reason, they do it... The songs aren't being done by the people who did the song. Maybe it's because the people who are nominees are in the audience and then they're like, they're prepared for getting an award.
It's an interpretation.
So they always have somebody else doing the song, whether it's just dancing or I can't remember it's singing to it. So, for example, they use the example of, they started this story off about the Phil Collins song, which I don't remember what song it was. What are you talking about?
It's Against All Odds from the movie Against All Odds.
Hey, Google, play Against All Odds by Phil Collins.
And see if you can play it better than mine.
If you keep talking over it, Google's not going to understand. Hey, Google, play Against All Odds by Phil Collins.
Against All Odds by Phil Collins. Sure. Play on Spotify.
Oh.
What happened there? Oh, I think I touched it a second time. Paused it. So this was from... What
so
was
take
from?
A look at me now.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Who,
So this won the Oscar. I think in 85 or 85, 86.
Who? What was this from? Well, let's look it up.
From the movie Against All Odds, starring Lloyd Bridges, James Woods, and Rachel Ward. It's a remake of a 50s noir thriller. It's about a football.
85.
It's about a football player, an American football
player.
No,
it lost.
Oh, it did?
In 84, it lost to the I Just Called to Say I Love You.
I just called.
Hey, Google.
Yeah, play that.
Play I Just Called to Say I Love You.
All right, I Just Called to Say I Love You by Stevie Wonder.
So this
playing on Spotify.
This song was in, so Against All Odds was Against All Odds. I Just Called to Say I Love You is the woman in red.
Yes.
And Phil Collins quoted in the lyrics saying, like, that he doesn't really think this was an original song. He think it was a song that Steve Wonder had in his library, or he just hadn't released it yet, and he just put it on this song.
Okay, so the rules for best original song are obviously the song has to have been written for the movie.
Yeah, maybe
it doesn't matter.
Released
for doesn't it. Matter when it's played in the movie. It just has to appear in the movie at some moment. Mm-hmm. I think it could be in the background in a scene when two characters
exactly.
are chatting
couple,
in the
couple,
diner.
Like Enchanted, a couple years ago, had yeah. three nominees at one time because
yeah.
it was all songs.
Right.
And that's one of the things they say, like, back in 1930s when they created this, this was a main outlet for songs.
Right.
Like, movies were. You didn't go out and get albums and things. You didn't have rock and pop in the same way.
Yeah.
So you definitely had songs that were popular songs.
Right.
But this was, like, a main avenue. Right.
Get rid of Stevie Wonder.
Okay, Google, stop. This is, they would have musical movies, and so the movies themselves were like partly songs, and it was
yes.
composed for those purposes.
And then,
so,
of course, you know, I think as time moved forward, the theme song became a thing, and I think the theme song really sort of came into its own during the 60s, at the same time that popular music as a commercial brand was bigger and bigger, and that people were buying 45-inch singles. So again, we're talking about the early 60s,
mm-hmm.
but the notion of the 3.5-minute track has been popularized by, you know, modern rock and popular music. And so therefore, songs were created, and, you know, 3 minutes is the perfect time to play movie, to play a song over the title credits. We are going to get to James Bond, which has made a thing out of that. But, you know, if you watch lots of films from especially the beginning in the 1960s, the credit sequence is accompanied by either a sung song or a instrumental version of a song that appears later in the film. And then, of course, you get to the stage, I think, probably fair to say in the late 80s and then early 90s, where you have original songs and then you have other songs that you want to sort of have appear in the movie that you can then flog a soundtrack to your movie full of, you know, popular records, to use that very sort of middle-aged
term. Well, I don't even
music.
Think they care about as much about the
soundtrack. No, not anymore, but there was a period,
but
there was a period there in the 90s and the early 2000s
but
where,
nowadays,
oh, yeah, wow, you know.
But nowadays, in part because of the fact that pop music doesn't have a regular album audience and it's harder for them to reach people through streaming
sure.
things. There's so many popular songs in
right.
movies, you know, like, you know, movies, they just go and grab the rights for a bunch of songs that already exist. They don't need to write a lot of new stuff.
So I think the gist of the Washington Post article, which we will link and stick out there within our blog post, was the fact that how reflective of a good song is the best original song?
Yeah, well, and you know, they're
and should the Oscars be in the song business at all? I think was sort of
yeah, because they certainly they basically part of it was they're saying
because here's
the thing: the songs they aren't good choices, right? Like, so it's a classic thing where people say, oh, you know, this was picked, but you know, it's a bad thing. So
it would be interesting, and again, this is because we haven't done our research. It would be interesting to see in the Grammys of that year, where did the Stevie Wonder song or the Phil Collins song end up?
Oh.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure.
Because ultimately, this was sort of point of the art. I think this was the point of the article was, you know, the Grammys, and to maybe a lesser extent, you know, it's sort of imitators like the MTV Awards and stuff like that, or whether it's country music and the Country Music Awards. But the music industry award shows, they're sort of the marker for this is a good song, this is a memorable song. Whereas the Oscars, it's almost slightly, I don't want to say like an add-on category, because it's not, but it's this weird sort of category where
it doesn't seem as integrated. It does seem like a tacked-on piece of. There's an original score award, of course, and that feels more like comprehensive,
right?
Like in terms of covering things.
And in a strange way, if it's best original song, and this is where the times have changed and the category hasn't. I mean, to your point, you know, back in the I think the Oscars started in the 30s, and I don't know when.
Yeah, this is the first words there, so like this isn't the first year, but like, hey, Google, play The Lullaby of Broadway.
All right, here's Lullaby of Broadway on Spotify.
I don't know if this will be the version that was in the movie for this sort of thing. But this is from Gold Diggers in 1935.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby
of Broadway. Yeah, we're bumping our heads.
But the paper faults this. Like, I would have thought this would be a pretty good win, but the paper faults this by saying, hey, Google. Hey, Google, play Cheek to Cheek.
All right, Cheek to Cheek by Frank Sinatra, playing on Spotify.
Which, by the way, can't be original because it's from 35, but... So they're saying Cheek to Cheek should have won, and from Top Hat, written by Irving Berlin.
Yeah. I don't know, but they both feel to me like legitimate winners and reflective of popular music at its time, which is sort of the point here.
Yeah, well, that's why, like, this one, I can't quite, like, I don't, which one was more deserving, I don't really know, but it basically seems to say, by year two, the Academy had blown it. Sung blissfully by Astaire, Cheek to Cheek, because the original is Astaire, is accompanied by perhaps the most famous pair's dance, blah, 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 whereas Lullaby Broadway was lame, or something like that. And the cares that hung around me. Hey, Google, play You Light Up My Life.
Okay, You Light Up My Life by Debbie Boone. Here it is on Spotify.
So in 1977, You to Light Up My Life from the movie.
What
you
movie?
Light Up My Life.
Oh, really? Who was in that? Who's in that movie?
I don't know. It doesn't really tell you anything about it. 70s represented evolution of stage songs to the anthems that would dominate the 80s and the 78 came Keith Carradine's I'm Easy, a solo guitar number from Nashville, blah, blah, blah. Then came the real screw-up. Paul McCartney's Live and Let Die in 1973 was the first of Bond songs to be nominated.
Still can't believe that song didn't win an Oscar. Who did it lose to that year?
I don't know. Let's see. You've got the printouts there, right?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. What year are we looking at here? 70.
Well, this is 77. Hey, Google. Play Nobody Does It Better.
Okay. Nobody Does It Better by Carly Simon. Here it is on Spotify.
So Nobody Does It Better lost to You Light Up My Life in 1977. So this was like the second or third Bond nominee. Now, You Light Up My Life, I tend to think of as a classic 70s song. How is the volume coming through on this? Can you hear this stuff on here?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting here. I'm gonna take one step back here and go back to Live and Let Die. Live and Let Die lost that year to The Way We Were.
Well, that was kind of a big song.
Okay, that's legit.
What's The Way We Were from?
Oh, it is from the movie The Way We Were, which I think is Robert Redford and Barbara Streisand, I think. So that's a legit, that was a legit sort of win. So this lost to You Light Up My Life. So yep. I guess you're saying that's fair. Although again...
I'm saying I tend to think of both the 70s, but this is clearly a better song than You Light Up My Life. Don't you think this is a better song?
Yeah, I think so, but then I'm biased. It's a James Bond song.
Carly Simon is better than Debbie Boone.
Well, anyway. And to be fair, this was written by Marvin Hamlisch, who also wrote The Way We Were. Because Marvin Hamlisch did...
Once we got into Bond,
I don't need any notes. Just bring it at me, man.
Now, by contrast, in 2015, Hey Google, play The Writings on the Wall.
Okay, Writings on the Wall by Sophia Carlberg.
Oops, that's not the right one.
Spotify.
Hey Google, stop. Hey Google, play Writings on the Wall from the Spectre soundtrack.
My apologies. I don't understand.
Play Sam Smith's Writing on the Wall. Oh no, here it is.
Well, that's weird. It's not.
But it's a version of it.
Yeah. Anyway, so
frankly, better than
the
one
paper
with Sam
basically
Smith.
Says. That says this was a bad win, that this is not a very good song, which probably in the pantheon of Bond songs is not really top flight.
No, it's not, but to be entirely fair...
Hey, Google, play Till It Happens to You.
All right, Till It Happens to You by Lady Gaga, playing on Spotify.
Is that? I didn't realize this is a Lady Gaga song. So this is from The Hunting Ground, which is a documentary about, like, bad things. So we don't have to get into that. But so So Bond's been on either side of the equation as far as the Washington Post is concerned.
Well, Bond won for the first time with Adele Skyfall, which is quite interesting.
That was
the
first win?
That was the first ever win by a Bond song, which is kind of only like 22 movies in.
Yeah.
And again, there are some great Bond songs. I mean, how many people cannot sing Goldfinger?
Right.
So let me go back and look at the winners for 1964. I think it's 64 or 65, and see who won that year. And I think this was sort of the whole point of this article was the Oscars' original song doesn't really seem to be reflective of... All right, so I'm just double-checking here. I think Goldfinger is 1964.
Mm-hmm.
Song from Mary Poppins.
Chim Chimney.
It wasn't even nominated.
Okay. Chim Chim Sherry by Dick Van Dyke, Matthew Garber, Karen Dodris, Julie Andrews. Here it is on Spotify.
I mean, it's kind of, you know, this is harkens back to the old musicals.
I mean, it's a great song.
Yeah.
But this is what I'm saying. When I hear...
I mean, I'm not going to have it on my soundtrack that I listen to driving down the road, whereas I might have Goldfinger.
And I am going to have Dick Van Dyke from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which you've covered before on this show. So there you go. But Dick Van Dyke is making it onto my device. You might think a sweet on the bottom. Well, all right, turn that down for a moment because I want to make an
issue. Hey, Google, stop.
I want to make a point here. While I said earlier that the 60s was a time when popular music as its own had become an art form, so the 3 and 4 minute song from popular artists, a song like that from Mary Poppins, and maybe this is why the Oscars need to be more specific about what it means to have an original song. That's the best song from a musical.
Yeah.
So it is an integral part film. And I think what irritates me a little bit... let's fast forward to 1997 and maybe take a shot at our good old buddy Titanic. My Heart Will Go On from the movie Titanic. That's James Horner and that's what's her name?
Hey Google, play My Heart Will Go On.
That won Best Oscar.
By Celine Dion, Vienna Boys Choir, sure. Playing on Spotify.
I'm going to regret this, but... There's quite a few, like, also with Return of the Animated movies,
remember,
Lion King.
Well, that's the thing. Do you remember when this song plays in the movie?
No. I mean, first of all...
That's what I'm saying. When does she sing it?
She ain't sing it. Who's singing?
Celine Dion.
Oh, like in the movie, when does she sing it?
Yeah, if I'm watching...
Because she's not in the movie.
That's what I'm saying. If I'm sitting there watching the film, when does this song in this specific form occur?
Yeah.
She doesn't sing it over the titles.
No. It might be at the end when they're like...
Over the closing credits she sings? Or does she sing? You know when
credits are like when they go back to the present day. No, I don't think
when
it's
when... they stand on the boat and he says, I'm the king of the world.
Obviously, because that would interfere with it.
Well, and this is my point here about best... About if you're going to win an Oscar, maybe they need to revisit what the song means. It either plays in its entirety... No, let me take that back. It plays in its original form over the credits or at some moment during the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I do feel a little bit that there's a lot of gaming the system if you're trying to win an Oscar for your song.
Yeah.
Oh, well, stick it in over the end credits. But that don't count because everyone's left.
Yeah, do you think when they put a song and they actually think about the Oscar piece, or is it just sort of gravy? Like, considering we barely knew this category existed.
Oh, no, on the contrary. I think this is an important...
In terms of the movie, but I mean, do you think they're thinking, oh, you know what, this might get a best song nod?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Hey, Google, play Let It Go. I'm going to play some of the best ones.
Let It Go by Idina Menzel.
I mean, listen...
Here it is on Spotify.
I know there's a lot of people out there who have been listening to their kids singing this over and over again, but, you know, listen, you can't
go wrong. What song is this?
What song is this?
I don't know. I'm looking through the bits of paper to try and find it. Is this a winner?
Oh, yeah, this is a winner from 2013, from Frozen.
No, I haven't seen that.
Really? You should see it.
No.
You should. No, it's important. It's like a cultural touchstone. Like, if you want to know what any youth that'll be coming up, especially, in your vocation. Like, all these kids, like, they totally identify with Frozen.
Yeah, but I don't. I'm a man of indeterminate middle age. This is no concern.
But it doesn't matter. This is about how you relate to people.
Here are some other winners, though, while this plays.
Well, there's one. Don't say that one, because I'm
okay.
saying that.
It's hard out here for a pimp. That was a famous
winner.
That
was a big deal. That was the... because I think that was the first hip-hop-oriented one, I think. Hustle and Flow, right?
Maybe. Oh, right. Okay. Maybe. Let it go. Let it go. All right, I know what the song is. Can't hold it back anymore. Let it go. Let it go. Turn away and slam the door. I don't care. Oh, please. Yeah, I've heard this before. I'd lose that. Yeah.
Here's really the best one of all time, though. Hey, Google, play... Oosh, I can't find it.
Who is it?
Hey, Google, play Lose Yourself.
I looked for... I can't find it.
Oh, come on. What, I heard hey, talking. Google. Hey, Google, you suck.
That's not cool. Well, hey, Google, play Lose Yourself.
All right, Lose Yourself by Eminem. Playing on Spotify.
Like, I wouldn't have even realized this was just from the movie. I just would have assumed it was from his album. But it's probably the, like, most... I think, well, who knows? It's hard to compare to the 70s films, but it's most clearly like a song that could have just been a song, and they actually made it for the movie.
Well, and here's the interesting thing. One of the other songs that it beat out was from the musical Chicago. That was the same year
that's this original stuff. I mean, Chicago is obviously a play beforehand, so I don't think they made new songs for the...
The song from Chicago, I Move On, which we'll play next.
We will.
Well, if you want to. Opportunity. Seize everything you ever wanted. Because this plays over the title track, over the titles. At the start of 8 Mile. Yeah. His palms are sweaty, knees weak, arms are heavy. There's vomit on his sweater already. Mom's spaghetti, he's nervous, but on the surface he looks calm and ready to drop bombs. But he keeps on forgetting what he wrote down. The whole crowd goes so loud, he opens his mouth, but the words won't come out. He's choking how? Everybody's choking now. The clock's run out, time's up, over, plow. Snap back to reality, oh, there goes gravity. Oh, there goes gravity, he choke. He's so mad, but he won't get.
A
great song.
Exactly. But it well, that's why like I said, might be one it, of the.
It beat
if
out.
We, if we were doing one of our things of all time competitions, it would be like, "Hey Google, play I Move On from Chicago."
All right, I Move On by Catherine Zeta-Jones, Renee Zellweger.
Oh, it's even the movie version.
Yeah. Spotify.
Are you saying this is a bad win? I don't understand. You're saying 8 Mile beat point. This? Oh, okay. It's Kander and Ebb, so it's the original writers from the play.
So, but they wrote this for the movie.
Did they?
I don't know. What's best original song? I guess it's got to be original for the movie.
Unless it's just original for the piece or something like that, you know.
All right, get rid of that.
Hey, Google, stop.
I don't know. I find, and again, I think that Eminem song is a great song. I think I actually didn't know that it had won an Oscar until I just looked at the sheet here. Because my default, which everyone's default is to the Oscars, which is this bunch of middle-aged white guys voting on stuff. I am surprised that Eminem was able to win that category. But I do find it interesting that it beat out, for example, that song, which is from a musical.
Yeah.
It's
apples and oranges, right?
So that's what I'm saying. Maybe musicals should have that.
This one, what year it won, but it's obviously from Wizard of Oz, so it must have been like, it had to be 30s, right?
Gotta be late 1939.
See, because was the sound was
And I also want to say something
was
here.
Wizard of Oz a play before it was a movie? I think it might have just went to the movie because it was a book.
No, I think it's just a movie. It's
and
a book.
It
it's become a movie, play, but now it's become a play. It's also become like the prequel play and the reboot play and the African American version play.
And to bring the
Wizard of Oz is a, you know.
And to bring all of our podcast full circle, here's one that I didn't even realize was from a movie, and let alone won the Oscar.
I'm looking through the shit. I don't even know what this is.
Yeah, you will in a sec.
You didn't know it was from, of course you knew it was from, White Christmas.
Well, I didn't know if it was like from the movie, from Holiday Inn.
Yeah, the movie's called Holiday Inn.
So, but I just would have thought it was a song of its own. It might have shown up in a movie, but let alone, like, I didn't know it was, like, original to the movie.
Well, but that's the thing, though. Back then, songs didn't show up. They were in the movie, and then they did what they did. And that's why this category seems to sort of be all over the place.
Yeah.
Do you know, the other thing I've noticed by looking through all the years of the winners here, some years there's, like, five songs in the category.
I'm looking at 43. There must be, like, 10 nominees.
There's, like, 10 nominees. There's no rules at all. I just get them all up there.
And then, like, later on, there's, like, three.
So I feel it's sort of like a cheap...
88 had three with Working Girl, Let the River Run. I don't even know what that is. I think there's 9 to 5. Did 9 to 5 win sometime? What year would that have been?
9 to 5 would have been...
Hey, Google, play 9 to 5.
No, it didn't win. It lost to Fame.
Oh, well.
Okay, which 9 is fair to 5 enough. By yeah. Dolly Parton. Here it is on Spotify.
In fact, there were two songs from Fame that beat it. Fame.
Oh, here's your Lalo Schifrin, though, in 80. Look at
yeah,
that.
He's my boy, yeah.
I mean, pretty rough to make that lose, but they were up against.
They were up against Fame. I want to
go play Fame.
I mean,
all right, Fame by Irene Cara, playing on Spotify.
Yeah, kind of hard to. Serious stuff. And then the following year, hey Google, play Arthur's theme.
All right, Arthur's theme by Christopher Cross, playing on Spotify.
So this was a year they beat the Bond movie For Your Eyes Only, or Bond song For Your Eyes Only. Also, the Great Muppet Caper, first time it happened.
Yeah, I want to say something now. The best original song is this wonderfully democratic and very open competition, because in a strange way it has nothing to do. Every other category in the Oscars at some level reflects the best, what's known as the better films. What I'm saying is, it's very rare that you ever see a best actor or best supporting actor in a film that you go, that film was cobblers, right? look at the people this year. The actors are from, you know, I, Tonya. I think there's a couple of nominees from that. Great film. Three Billboards. Great film. You know, there are a lot of... most of the actors and editing and cinematography are all drawn from films that in general are quite well regarded. In the last 20 years, I'm going to name some of the films that have found their way into the Oscars via the best original song. I mean, and there are some donkeys in here. Let me have a look here. Rocky 3, Karate Kid 2. Beverly Kills Cop 2. It should have been nowhere near the Oscars. Let me have a look here. A movie called Buster. That's actually a Phil Collins movie. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. I mean, no, I'm sorry. Home Alone, that we've got. Young Guns 2. Young Guns 2. I'm going to name some other movies here. Beethoven's Second.
Are these winners or nominees? Sorry.
These are nominees.
Ah, well, that doesn't
Beethoven's,
matter.
Beethoven, and none of the Beethoven's franchise should only be anywhere near the Oscars for best performance by a dog. I'm going to keep going here with just some of these movies that are like, so One Fine Day. That's that George Clooney movie that sucks with Michelle Pfeiffer. Up Close and Personal. That's a Michelle Pfeiffer movie that sucks. Con Air. The movie Con Air has an Oscar nomination thanks to the best original song. Babe, Pig in the City. So not the original Babe, but it's a classic, but the sequel. Quest for Camelot. I don't even know what that movie is. Toy Story 2. Okay, I'll give you that. South Park, Bigger, Longer, and Uncut. Well, that should have been in there because that's a great movie. One of these versions of Tarzan. Seriously? We've covered Tarzan. Yeah, it doesn't even flow anymore. Lord of the Rings movies. The movie Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor gets an Oscar nomination. The Wild Thornberrys movie. movies like that shouldn't be anywhere near the Oscars. Security should be going, nope, you're not coming in. Let's see what else here.
I mean, you get some of that in like the...
But you get a lot of that in this...
Yeah, but you get that in like, you know, cinematography and editing and stuff like that, I guess, too.
You think?
Yeah, like sound editing.
I don't know. I mean, Country Strong, never heard of that. Tangled, I've even heard of that movie. Ted, which I liked, but come on now. I just...
All right, we have one more topic to cover.
All right, let's get there.
All right.
What's the topic? Because I will come up with a segue. So anyway, best original song in the Oscars? Yeah, stupid. Get it out.
Yeah.
Let's get rid of it. Really. I'm always one of those saying, let's get rid of some of these lower, or at least move the lower level honors to a different night so that the Oscars isn't 3.5 hours, which is the reason why I'm not watching it anymore. I think the original song only exists as much to flesh out the TV show. This should be removed and stuck on a different night.
It can't start in the 30s. That can't be right. It exists. Okay. Yeah, so like, All right, basketball, college basketball.
Okay.
We're heading into conference tournaments and the NCAA tournaments.
And you are very excited.
Yeah, you know, UVA,
yes.
University of Virginia, ranked number one in the country for quite a few weeks now, have closed out the season with the most wins ever in ACC history.
Yeah.
Look at you, beaming. That's aided by the fact that the ACC now has a longer conference schedule than ever before, but they're 17-1 in the conference.
Let me ask you a question about, obviously, your team. UVA not under investigation for giving money to players? Okay, just double check.
We're wonderful.
No, that's fine.
They were just featured checking. On the front of the Ringer, their coach, on his whole like philosophy of coaching.
Tony Bennett?
We don't have any big stars. Yeah, exactly. No relation to who? Us?
Well, Tony Bennett.
Oh, okay.
Who might have won an Oscar if the things were better organized.
He might have won an Oscar. We didn't really read all the lines.
Who knows who he lost to over the years. But there you go. Frank Sinatra's never won an Oscar.
The only downside to Virginia winning so much is that it gets harder to get tickets. So we went down for Virginia versus Georgia Tech, which was a pretty mediocre game.
Georgia Tech are terrible, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But still on StubHub, you know, the tickets were $50 or something like that for upper decks.
Okay.
I had looked just because I was trying to figure out the ticketing at the Virginia Tech game, the one that Virginia Tech unfortunately upset Virginia at. But those tickets were going for like 100 and change, you know.
Yeah.
And that in Virginia Tech, you know, from a basketball perspective, they're a bigger deal now, but it's not like playing Duke or something. So now it's tough to get tickets there. And I know some people that are playing the ACC tournament up in Brooklyn. People will be going to that. So starting on Thursday afternoon, I need to make sure I have a long enough lunch hour to watch the game there. Although,
they'll be on a night time, won't they?
No, the first ACC.
Oh, really?
The one seeds get the early times.
Oh, okay. You get the most rest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have that, and then the NCAAs will come out, and all things being equal, I expect Virginia to be a number one seed, and then everybody in their pools can pick against them because they continue to get upset every year in the tournament. But that's about it for Virginia. There's really not that much more to say about it unless you have anything.
So you just wanted to shout out your team?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, all right.
But then I also wanted to talk about, because you're a big fan of Georgetown, not a local team, not going to the tournament, I assume, right? I didn't follow them very closely. I went to a game earlier in the year.
Yeah.
But they have a new signee, Mac McClung.
6'1".
6'2", I think, or at least
he's 6'1".
Yeah, so he's from Gate City, Virginia, which is
Gate City,
deep southwest Virginia. Like, you know, when you look at the map and it's got that little like curve that goes around West Virginia. I mean, he's very close to the Tennessee border on the way western corner of Virginia. The town itself, you know, the high school has less than 2,000 people in the town. And he's like, he broke Allen Iverson's Virginia all-time scoring record this year. Big on, like, 6'2", white guy. Like, dunks, like, I mean, through the legs stuff and tomahawks and all this stuff. Like, he clearly has got some serious athletic aptitude.
Yeah,
his videos have gone all viral.
And that's the point I wanted to make. He was originally a commit to Rutgers and then he decommitted.
Oh.
Well, he either didn't decommit or he changed his mind, but apparently Rutgers thought they had him, and then when Patrick Ewing became coach and started recruited over him, so now he's going to Georgetown. He has become... I have no idea how good he's going to be.
I'm going to say not very.
I don't think he's going to be that good because you say he's 6'2". Everything I read, he's 6'1".
Yeah.
So he's probably slightly undersized for all that dunking. He does play in a more rural area. I think he's in a private school league. So I'm not sure statistically how padded his stats are.
Is it private school league? Gate City? I think it's Gate City.
It's a small,
It's a small thing, because they were playing Radford in like a state championship.
Yeah, what's made him notable... is that he is, and I'm kind of surprised that he is one of the first. He has become almost a one-man cottage industry of
getting hold of his own highlights and posting them up to YouTube and Twitter and Instagram, and everyone jumping in. Obviously, people at Georgetown have all been following along.
Yeah.
But because of...
He's posting... And there's a... I saw it's the Hoop... I forget what the Hoop website was that posted a lot of his highlight reels.
I mean, he seems to have more highlight reels than any other recruit in his class. And I just find that whole notion of it interesting.
I watched some of it today. I'm sure you watched some of it.
I've watched
there's a lot of this dunking where everybody on the other team is standing still.
Yes.
Nobody getting away.
As a Georgetown fan, I'm obviously excited. I do think the program is getting better. I think Patrick Ewing's doing a good job. He's been recruiting his 7'1" frame off. I am a bit concerned, though, with any player who comes in with so much hyperbole, especially in this day and age where it's all dunks and 30-second clips and this sort of thing. And I find it's an interesting phenomenon, although unsurprising, because we're now in an industry, if you look at, what's his name, who continually spars with the president from the NBA and his son, Ball.
Oh,
we're in an industry where everyone, if you're an athlete, whoever you are,
well, it's the father in that case.
The whole notion is that you are an entity and a property and an industry of yourself.
Sure.
Whereas we're still from a generation where people play and they make their salary, and isn't that great? And they may do a couple of commercials, the better they are. But nowadays, if you're any kind of an athlete, you are this sort of one person brand and entity. And clearly, Mac McClung, he's either going to be great. He's either going to be great. He's going to completely bomb. Or he's going to be somewhere in the middle. One thing I know for certain.
You're going out on a limb there.
Well, no, but what I mean is, one thing I know for certain is, because I don't know which one of those things he will be. I think he'll actually be somewhere in the middle. Is for a while, he is already this interesting sort of cottage industry of clips that go viral. Did you see this dunk? Did you see that dunk? And it's just. Yeah, it's a.
I'm sure he'll be in the middle, but I think it's going to be that big a deal. If he was that big a deal, particularly from that area, you would have seen Carolina and Duke all over.
Yes, he wouldn't have been decommitting from Rutgers to go to Georgetown
or even Virginia Tech. It's right there in his backyard.
But I cannot decide. And again, I'm not having a pop at him because I'm excited that he's coming. I think he's going to make us better. But regardless, I cannot decide if this is a good or a bad thing. That if you are of that ilk, do you want to be putting yourself out there?
Like, is it good
so
or bad
far
for him?
So far before the verdict is in. Because again, to my point just now, he's either going to be great, okay. All right. Or he's going to be just okay. Fair enough. Or he's going to bomb. You're unnecessarily putting yourself out there. You know, like anything in life, if you have a reputation that precedes you,
then
what I'm saying is you do set yourself up for failure later if you don't live up.
I don't know about failure is the right word, but unless he's quite good, it could become one of these stories where it's like, oh, you know, that's about the goofy hype and like people just don't believe that anymore, you know, I'm trying to think, you know, like the quarterbacks who would do great in college and then they go off to the pros.
Google
and
play Public Enemies, don't believe the hype. I mean, do you know what I mean? It's this weird stuff. I'm glad Google didn't hear me there. That's a great song, though, from a great album.
Yeah.
There's my point, though, to hype.
Right. But I don't know if that matters. Like, I mean, does it matter? I mean, he could still end up with a contract at or is doing something, you know, maybe he could end up joining like a show team or something like that, like the Globetrotters, or playing in Europe because somebody will grab him for the fame thing. But it's an interesting play for Georgetown, I think, because, you know, Georgetown for years was one style, and then they had that sort of Princeton offense, and nobody really knows exactly what Ewing's doing.
Ewing is going to play a very physical, high-pressure defense, but the offense will be the sort, I think he's quoted somewhere saying this at somewhere down the line, it is clearly going to be more NBA-influenced, because in reality, that's what all these kids, they all believe they're going to go there. So he does feel that forcing them, and it's interesting where you've just done talking about Tony Bennett, who has a system that is not, I wouldn't say the antithesis of the NBA, but, you know, Tony Bennett has great collegiate teams, but how many guys from recent UVA rosters are in the NBA?
Four.
Oh, okay, so that's pretty
well, the thing with Tony, it's a different thing. Like, so he's playing to, Ewing's playing to the, okay, this is the way the NBA people play, but apparently, like, part of this article I was reading about Tony Bennett is about people who who they learned how to play defense at a level that now equipped them to go to the NBA and be useful players, even above their like obviously native.
But I get it. If you're a college coach and you're in some kid's living room,
four or five.
I mean, give Tony Bennett his due with the sort of kid that he's recruiting. But the majority of kids that college coaches are recruiting, to be fair, are not swayed by that argument.
Yeah,
they want to hear the college coach say, yeah, you're going to be the next Steph Curry or you're going to be the next LeBron and you're going to the NBA. I mean, that's how this business is now, which makes what Tony Bennett does so, to his credit, and so such a great achievement.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, Ewing obviously is a guy whose pedigree is.
Right. Well, that's obviously what
he should be selling. He should be selling the NBA because he was an NBA assistant coach for 20 years. Well, so
he also played in the NBA, so that'd be a good
thing. Yeah, and he played in the NBA. So what I'm saying is that, he is, he's an NBA. I think he's in the Hall of Fame for the NBA.
To his credit, Tony Bennett played in the NBA too. But
then did he?
Busted his knees up. He was Charlotte Hornets. He was backup to, I think, Muggsy Bogues when he started out.
To his credit, the other Tony Bennett has played in NBA arenas. No relation.
I assume.
Yeah. So there you go. Yeah. So we just, I just think it's interesting. If you go online and you just type in Mike McClung.
The other thing I meant to mention, my laptop shut down because I ran out of batteries, oddly enough.
You see some good dunks, I will say that.
So there's an article in the Post, and this is the kind of thing that ticks me off, is people who like try to write with flourish. And
do it. Get it off your chest.
So unfortunately, I don't have the sentence in front of me anymore. And I don't remember who the author of the article, but it starts off by saying how he throttled down the court. And throttled down the court, I know what they mean is like accelerated like a car.
That's bad use of the...
But the word throttle is to choke off, even with cars, when you don't throttle
the
car forward.
Well, if you throttle
forward,
down, it's a badly constructed sentence.
You open the throttle. The whole point is the throttle is that... I think that's your phone ringing.
Is that my phone?
I think so.
Coming through my thing? That's going to decline that, so I don't know what happened there.
Can you actually do that? Your phone comes through your computer?
I think it does when my phone is near it, but I actually can't find my phone. So
it's probably upstairs.
And I'm never going to find it now because I've turned the ringer off. So who knows? It's not on me. So I don't know who that was.
So this thing that said throttle down the court, and I was like, come on now. Like, I mean, if you want to use a car metaphor, you better know what the car metaphor actually means, because a throttle is what restricts the flow of gas. You could open the throttle, but that doesn't make for a good sentence there. But you don't throttle down the court.
It's a bad use of the phrase on every level, either as a journalist or as someone, don't you like cars? So you're offending me as someone who likes cars and someone who reads.
It's in the sports section. Didn't some editor in the sports section go, wait a minute, I don't think this word means what you think it means. And then the next line was something about how he had spring for legs. It was like all this flourish about his abilities. And I was like, you're trying too hard.
Well, I think all the best people at the Post are currently trying to, everyone's been told, get stuff on Trump. So... So all the copy editors and all the junior fellas, they really are copy editors and junior fellas, which is why the everyday writing is getting into the Post, because all the people who can string a sentence together have been told to do something on Trump. So
different focus.
I think, is that it for the show?
I think so.
This has been the Atlantic Voice Podcast. I'm Zeph.
And I'm Eric. Take care.
You've just enjoyed Eric and Zeph on the Atlantic Voice Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at @Atlantic_voice. You can find the show at Libsyn.com, iTunes, and of course at AtlanticVoice.net. Email us at AtlanticVoice@gmail.com. And now on YouTube, search for The Atlantic Voice. The Atlantic Voice, 3,000 miles of opinion.